The man is perfect. There's no other explanation. How else could you forgive the guy who infected you?
You're listening to the Still Queer as Folk podcast. Each week we take down an episode of Showtime's Queer as Folk TV show to find out if it still holds up 17 years later. I'm Patrick Randall.
And I'm Matt Dominguez.
Thanks for listening to Still Queer as Folk. If you take a minute to click the subscribe button right now, it will cost you nothing, but you'll never miss an episode of our quaint little show.
You can also find us on Facebook as Still Queer as Folk, and we just started tweeting at Still Queer AF.
This episode is called You Say It's Your Birthday? I Couldn't Care Less. It's number 16 in season 2 of Queer as Folk.
That's a terrible title.
Yeah, it made sense though. I thought that at first too, and then I got to the end and I was like, hey, that title actually meant something this time around.
I think it's a little on the nose, but it's fine. This episode first aired on May 12th, 2002.
It was directed by Bruce McDonald, my favorite Queer as Folk director, though close tie with Russell Mulcahy. This is Bruce McDonald's third episode, and he directs 5 more episodes in the series.
You say it's your birthday? I couldn't care less. I'm trying to acknowledge the punctuation as well. It was written by executive producers Ron Cohen and Daniel Lipman, and the teleplay was by Michael McLellan. He wrote 14 episodes of Queer as Folk and also wrote 2 episodes of The Fosters, which, Patrick, as you know, I have started. I'm already on season 2 and I am loving it. And he also produced 10 episodes of The Fosters.
Here's a recap of You Say It's Your Birthday, I Couldn't Care Less from Queer as Folk, the book.
Justin and Ben share a birthday, but their boyfriends have very different plans for marking the occasion.
Michael plans a surprise party that blows up in his face when Ben lashes out in front of all the guests after learning his infection has become resistant to the cocktail. That's a
I don't
dated
like that for,
term.
Yeah. Brian decides to ignore Justin's birthday entirely, so Justin goes to a violin recital and meets a cute violinist.
That's what you would meet at a violin recital, right?
I would think so.
Meanwhile, Ted attends a gay celebration church. I don't know what that means. And meets a really great guy and lies about his job.
He doesn't really lie. He lied. Creatively told.
He works in relief. He works for a relief organization.
I don't see the lie, but we'll get into it.
I put that as just a runner in this story. For the A story, I've got it down as Michael and Ben.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that it was just an amazing coincidence that Justin and Ben have the same birthday.
An amazing coincidence.
And probably done for budgetary reasons in this show. They couldn't give each person their own birthday episode, so get
it together. So we got to do a 2-for-1 special here.
I like how Michael had decided to just throw a surprise party for Ben and then just steals his palm, which is a Palm Pilot, which is a very early personal digital assistant. I owned one at one point.
Did you have the stylus and everything?
I did.
Yes.
I think I traded it for an air conditioner or something, like a window air conditioner.
I feel like that's a bartering system that doesn't quite work, but that's funny.
I traded it for something. God, I can't remember what it was.
Right. Yeah. I was looking for his palm. I remember how amazingly 2002 that was.
It almost had a little branding angle to it because we keep hearing Ben talk about, where the hell is my palm? And if I had my palm and... where is my palm? It just kind of got a little annoying. It was like, let's throw technology into the episode. The palm.
Okay, where the hell is my palm?
Try my bedroom. You know, may have dropped out of your pocket while you were dropping out of your pants.
Good thinking, boy toy wander.
Stole it?
Borrowed it. Ben's got a buddy list in here, so I'm going to call everybody on it and invite him to a surprise party.
Did you notice... during this scene when they're going through the copious amounts of drawings for Rage, the amount of like quick zooms that were happening on their faces, it caught my eye. And I was sort of distracted for a minute. I'm like, why is Bruce McDonald using this film technique for just this moment?
Yeah, I like the Bruce McDonald technique, though, in general. I like being surprised by him. And I've always thought that the episodes that he does really give the show a different look. It looks like he put some thought into it, whereas some of them shoot it almost like a soap opera. They've got single camera, one chance to do the take. But Bruce McDonald tends to find these interesting angles. There's more exteriors that he does. It's much more layered and interesting looking. I noticed something, though, that Michael and Ben have been dating for just a few months. Michael thought that it was a good idea to throw him a surprise party, steal his address book, and then invite a ton of strangers over to the house.
How does he know that these people are his friends?
Right.
This could be just acquaintances, a person that he had a meeting with once 3 years ago. Like, how does he discern that these are his friends?
I think
it's a big risk he's taken.
Yeah, if you look at through my contact list, I wouldn't want all those people invited to my birthday party.
Oh, God, no.
Maybe Ben tags them very well. It's like, X, infected me. X, friend of friend, acquaintance. Well, because we meet the guy that infected Ben.
I know, so but Jesus.
Maybe he tags it so that maybe that's how Michael is able to invite all these strangers over to the house. I just thought it was weird that Michael would do something like that so early in the relationship. You'd think that this first birthday party would be like just the two of them.
Haven't they also kind of proclaimed their love for each other already?
Oh, yeah.
So I feel like this whole thing is moving fast anyway.
Yeah. I had forgotten that Debbie was still rather meh about Ben because he's positive. And that came back into play. I think it's getting old, though. I'm kind of tired of seeing Debbie all frumpy over it.
I'm very not on this train of Debbie disapproving of Ben, especially when she and Vic are talking about it, and she describes it saying that she I will tolerate but not endorse.
Yeah.
I'm like, that kind of language is just a real turnoff for this character.
Yeah, I just – she would let Michael get on with his own life and just stop bringing this up. I think we're only on like the third episode where she's been harping on it, but it's like enough already. I'm tired of it.
To me, it just doesn't track with her character. Or I feel like they've done enough of saying that she and Michael have had their reconciliation of they're going to support one another in each other's relationship, especially after they had that blow up over the detective.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I thought this would have squashed her issues with Ben, but apparently not.
I did like this cute moment in the park when Ben bought Michael flowers. I like that.
And it's interesting how it comes up later with Justin and Brian.
Ben tells Michael that he doesn't want anything special for his birthday.
You know, while we're on the subject of your birthday.
Yes, while we're on it, please, nothing special. Let's just keep it simple and low key, okay?
And he was very clear about that in the park with the flowers. I thought it was just a little annoying that Michael just blithely ignored that.
I feel like
just kept going full throttle with this surprise party. It's like, dude, he just said, don't do that.
It's such a typical trope when it comes to birthday episodes. The character's going to say, I don't want to do anything. Person's going to interpret that as, oh, I have to do something big. Yeah. And then it blows up in their face. And then everyone's supposed to be surprised that it did.
Yeah.
Like, I know it's probably not the most dramatically interesting thing for a character to be like, oh, you don't want anything? Okay. I mean, at some point, it's kind of a cliche it's a cliche that gets played out, and we see it a lot.
And then, lo and behold, here comes this guy trotting down the Rue de Liberté.
Nice guy.
Oh, yeah, he's a sweetheart. Actually, he and I were together about 5 years ago.
Oh.
No, we stayed friends, although at the time it was not easy.
Wait, isn't that about the time that you found out that you were
positive? Yeah, he's the one who infected me.
Holy fuck.
No, it's okay. He didn't know, and I should have been more careful. Anyway, I forgive him.
And I thought that was, like, so pragmatic of Ben to be forgiving. It was unexpected. I didn't remember that when I was watching the episode, so I was more or less seeing it for the first time, and I was thinking, oh, look at that.
Well, and Michael's reaction to that, because I think he says something like, holy fuck. And he looks like he was about to attack.
He's going
to
go after him.
Yeah, no, how Take dare a punch you? At him. But as you said, because Ben is so, has clearly
grounded found, in Eastern philosophy. Yeah.
Well, he's found his peace with it and has managed to forgive. And it's
found
even
his
something,
chakra.
And it's something so simple as him saying, he didn't know. I should have been more careful. I've forgiven him.
Ben, here we find that Ben's at peace with it, which is interesting because later in the episode, he's not quite at peace with this.
I agree that it's an interesting storyline that I don't think I've ever seen in exploring what it means to have a relationship or friendship or still have a connection to the person who was the cause of your HIV infection. I think that would have been interesting for the show to continue on.
Yeah, they could have done a little bit more with that. But I also think that the writers in the past have given us an awful lot of background on Ben. So he became infected, then he like traveled to Tibet and Thailand, and he was meditating and he took up Buddhism. So it seems like there's a whole other unspoken or unshown story that we don't know too much about, but it seems like Ben went through this journey to kind of get clean with it and to accept it and move on and make his life as extraordinary as he could, irregardless of his status. So I think that's kind of a little bit of a stretch for most viewers here. You really have to pull in an awful lot of past Ben history to really get there.
Sure. And I know he's not one of our main characters because that would involve, I mean, I feel like that could be a few episodes to cover all of that.
Yeah, you're right. This early in Ben's appearance, he's not one of the lead cast members, really. He has yet to really get his own storylines. I think this is one of his first. Later on, he has some really, really deep and dark stories that I like. But for now, he's a little kind of fringy, I think. There's a nice return of the social gym. I was happy to see that. And this is only kind of marginally related to the Michael and Ben story in that Michael was there. There was conversations going back and forth with them, but it was just so nicely shot. There were quick cuts back and forth as they're doing their, quote, workout.
I didn't understand their workout routine.
Yeah, they were doing jumping jacks.
There was some cardio happening. There was some chest happening. There was some legs happening. I wasn't following what their focus was today. But I know that the whole social gym moment was an opportunity for Michael to mention how perfect Ben is.
The man is perfect. There's no other explanation. How else could you forgive the guy who infected you?
Trying nuts.
If it were me, I'd want to kill him.
Ben's not like that. He's managed to free himself from all the emotional baggage that the rest of us carry around.
Wonder how he does it. I guess. He sings a lot of show tunes.
I love that moment when that was said opposite of Ted saying that he lied to the second grade teacher. And we'll talk about that in a minute, but this was still in the same context of the scene. So there was just a string of multiple takes of everybody saying, what, 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 what?
Yeah. I almost expected some rando to appear in the cut too.
Yeah. Huh?
Just walking by.
One thing I noticed about this gym scene though, is there's a super buff guy in the background doing pull downs on one of the cable machines, but he had like 20 pounds on the machine, and this guy is huge.
Just in the background. Maybe he was doing a lot of reps. Maybe that's what it was. Maybe he's trying to lean and not bulk.
Because you see him, you know, pull it down, and then you just see like one plate
come up. The show wasn't banking on people to pay attention that closely to the faded, to the out of focus background.
Yeah. You had talked about Debbie a few minutes ago. I thought that was a great scene with Vic and Debbie. When they were having that conversation, I just love it when these two characters, Jack Weatherall and Sharon Gless, get to play off of each other. We've seen a lot of this in the last several episodes. My favorite was in the backyard when they're raking leaves. Now we get them together again. They're folding clothes. I really, really like watching them because they make the characters so believable.
I thought you were going to make more of an effort where Michael and Ben are concerned.
Do you see me giving him any grief?
I don't see you giving him any joy.
I agreed to tolerate it, not endorse it.
Well, maybe you could up your commitment a notch. You've got to admit, Ben's been a positive influence on him.
Positive? Exactly.
And despite all of your darkest fears and dire predictions, they both seem to be doing just fine. So why not be a sport? And make the kid happy.
The thing I like about Jack and Sharon here is that they can take some pretty mediocre lines and really turn them into something. And that's the part that I like about their performances. Some of the writing in Queer as Folk, as we've talked about, is thin.
Sure.
and these two actors can deliver it, though. They can just make me believe in some of the dialogue that sometimes comes up. So two of my favorite characters. This party, a surprise party.
Well, yes. I mean, you know it's not going to go...
Well, should we talk about the host of the party first?
Sure. So...
Emmett is our geisha host.
First of all, he described this party as a geisha sushi Miss Saigon-y kind of thing.
I didn't see Miss Saigon. Did it have any Miss Saigon in this party?
Oh, no. But this apparently was what he was pulling for, in which I was like, well, geisha and sushi is more Japanese. Miss Saigon takes place in Vietnam. So we're just sort of going for an overall Asian is what they're going for.
Far East.
Sure. Which, of course, this is all being pulled from the fact that Ben has done his, you know, meditation and trips, and he's pulled a lot of his philosophy from Buddhism and yoga, but they would be
more careful knowing that.
Well, yeah. And that's the thing. Like, you look at this episode and you look at this party, especially in 2018, and you know that this party would never happen the way it does today.
I don't know. The party itself didn't have much to it. There were red lanterns hanging around, and Michael wore a vaguely,
we think, some
Japanese
sort of
shirt.
A Japanese or Chinese shirt that had, you know, it was a symbol on this shirt.
And then Emma,
our character on his shirt.
Emma was really the rest.
It
wasn't like that party, the Pacific Northwest going away party for Dr. David and Michael, where everybody shows up in flannel and there's a moose. This party seemed to have been happening all in Emmett's head. He like envisioned the party to be something.
Well, and he
dresses up. And
yes, he gets this.
The decorations didn't match.
He gets this outfit from Uncle Vic
from some party that
he went to in the 70s. And the thing is, when Emmett opens the door, he is in full geisha, makeup and dress that. Oh boy. You look at it and like, this is what I believe we would typically call yellow face. Like, he is mimicking sort of broken Japanese English not so much Katsu, because at least with Katsu, the delivery boy,
yeah.
Yes, where it's rather exaggerated. And then, you know, he drops out of it, but he's still in this garb that, again, in 2018, like, you would think there would have been a producer or a writer going like, no, we're not doing that. Nope.
It seemed like back in the early 2000s, I vaguely remember a lot of fancy dress parties. They were theme parties. I don't remember one like this. It was mostly like, wear a certain color, or do your hair a certain way, or like an 80s party or something like that.
Sure. It's one thing to do a themed party that's based on, you know, a decade that, you know, it's very recognizable. The 80s, there are so many different kinds of fashion trends that you could pull from. But here, because it's so decidedly based on a culture that none of these guys seem to understand or truly know, it becomes a huge problem.
At best, it was off color. And I think at worst, it could be cultural appropriation.
I think I would personally label it definitely cultural appropriation and not appreciation. Like, there's a decided difference. Like, there's a way where you can show appreciation for the culture, but that's after you have done your research, and that there is a respect level. And I don't think in this episode, especially for this party, is that respect level is there. Now, for 2002, maybe it was, and no one would have really said much of anything. But looking at it today, which is, you know, what we strive for in this podcast, is we have to acknowledge that this is one of those problematic episodes of the series. And it makes me wonder, like, what could the creatives say today about it? Maybe because it's one episode out of many, they wouldn't think much of it, because they don't remember that they did certain things. But it would be an interesting point to bring up to the creatives today.
I think for me, Brian's delivery boy was a bigger transgression. That was when he was having his noodles delivered. This was, I think, in season one.
Mm-hmm.
And the delivery boy shows up and he was dressed like Short Round in Temple of Doom, Indiana Jones Temple of Doom.
Hello? Sesame noodle. Didn't forget this time.
I thought that was a very clear transgression. Emmett's like 20 seconds. Let's call it a minute of screen time as a, I wouldn't say a great geisha. It seemed a little tamer than that first one. Like, we didn't have so much of a problem with Katsu, the prostitute.
It's called corned beef, sweetie. It's a Jewish delicacy.
Okay. What do you suppose he's actually saying?
What's the matter? We're in love, love, love.
We both had a problem with the delivery boy. I'm trying to figure out where in that continuum or that spectrum Emmett's geisha hostess fits into it.
We didn't have so much a problem with Katsu as it was everyone else.
It was
else's.
Melanie, actually.
It was everyone's
no, it was
reaction.
Ted.
It was Ted. And yeah. it was everyone's reaction to Katsu.
Yeah, he was treated as a curiosity problem. And yes. Kind of like a let's have some fun. Let's put words into his mouth that he's really not saying.
Exactly.
And then Melanie spoke all access powers.
Talk to Melanie. Melanie speak all access powers.
In this moment, even though one could say it is tamer than the delivery boy, it's still a very uncomfortable thing to know that that's kind of like in 2002, people didn't see this much of an issue with it. But I feel like with the 2018 lens, there would be a lot more hubbub about it.
Well, apparently Ben also agrees with you because he showed up and threw a fit and kicked everybody out.
I told you I didn't want a party. I don't want to celebrate my goddamn birthday.
But Ben, all your friends.
Oh, yeah, my friends. I want my friends out of here now. Do you understand?
He did not mince words when he came in. And I was, maybe it was just me being very petty because I'm very over this Debbie not liking Ben thing. But the fact that she tries to use that as ammo, it's like, this is the man who's supposed to be good for my son. And she storms out. I was like,
yeah,
I had a very emotional reaction. I think I said, oh, screw off, Debbie. I literally said that to the team because I'm like, clearly he's dealing with something and he didn't want to have this party because he said that.
Well, Debbie didn't know that.
Right, right. But it feels like it's just like, it's just so easy to give her more ammo against Ben.
Yeah, that cattiness kind of irritated me too. It's like, once again, get over it, woman.
Seriously.
It's been three episodes. I also think that in this case, Ben should have rolled with this. His boyfriend put together a party. And even if he didn't want it, I think it falls into one of those pretend you like it moments, almost like a Christmas present that you don't like, but you want to be appreciative of the thought. So I didn't like that. He just blew up about it in such a, I guess, in a really aggressive way.
Well, he's coming in with the knowledge that, of course, we learn later in the episode about his doctor visit.
But what more reason than to like be with your friends, have a bunch of drinks, and live in the now? Remember, he lives in the now.
Right.
He was not in the now here.
Absolutely not, because this was news that he did not want to hear. So now, granted, that's where that tension comes from, is that we don't have this information. So, of course, yeah, we see Ben lashing out for what we believe to be that someone didn't respect his wishes of not having a party. And yes, it seems like overreacting.
From what we know of Ben, I would think that he would have been mentally prepared for this moment a long time ago. He would have known that this was going to come. This check was in the mail. It was going to happen sometime. And he even kind of alluded to it when he first met Debbie at Debbie's house. Debbie says, "Have you ever been hospitalized?" And she's saying, "What's your T-cell count?" And he was very pragmatic about it at that point. So it just seemed to me like this should not have shocked him. It might have put him into the dumps a little bit, but I don't know. From what I know of Ben so far, live in the now, dance until we drop. You know, it just seemed like I would have wanted Ben to be more put together in this moment, not go Incredible Hulk on Michael.
Now, I think on paper, sure. He has presented the ability to do such a thing. But, and I think this makes it for a more interesting development, to have him, okay, now you're faced with it. And then he realizes, oh, shit, none of the things I'm trying to do is really working for me right now. And it also helps the argument of him not being the perfect person that Michael has, you know, put him on this pedestal, because we see how, like, Michael sees this as like the end of the relationship with how he reacted at this party.
I didn't walk away thinking that, but I know the story well enough to know that it
sure.
So now that I think about it, yeah, because Michael did kind of start to walk away from the relationship.
Yes. I mean, let's look at that scene in the park where where Michael is with Brian, and Michael is just like,
he unloads.
He's like, I did this whole thing for him, and this is how he reacts. And I know, go with me on this, Patrick. I was 100% on Brian's side.
I just overloaded my microphone with that.
I thought you would like that. In that, Michael is ranting and raving about Ben's reaction, and shows that Ben is like somewhat of a human and not 100% perfect. That this whole idea that for Michael, it has to be all or nothing. Like, one little flaw in Ben has Michael running for the hills and just unloading all these things that he's feeling like. And it's like, it's one fight.
It wasn't even really a fight. He just threw everybody out and everybody left. It was like the Buddhist fight.
Yes. He's like, I need everybody out of here now. But yeah, it was
like, he didn't even recognize anybody in the room.
At first I thought he didn't. I thought that because the way he kept saying, oh, my friends. And he's looking around. I'm like,
yeah. How do you know who my friends are?
Right. So it was one fight about something that Ben had been clear about, saying, I don't want this. You do it anyway. Yeah. And then Michael has the nerve to be so offended by Ben's reaction. And I appreciated that Ben goes to Michael's and Emmett's apartment, I should say. And
oh, when he showed up and opened the door, he looked like he had been like dragged around the neighborhood for a while.
He might not have slept because he has all this news, and Michael thinks like, oh, well, don't you worry about me ever having to share, you know, celebrate a birthday with you, because we'll never do that again. Like, he's like, he thinks this is the end of the relationship.
It was so awkward to see Ben take a fall over something, and then he's awkwardly smoking.
Since when do you smoke?
Since I'm nervous, Michael. You stop looking at me like that. Please, I'm not perfect, you know?
Yeah, I'm finding that out.
Well, God knows I have tried. Eastern religion, meditation, yoga, you name it. I have practiced it, hoping to achieve some state of inner harmony. And then this happens, and I realize the only thing I have achieved is to convince myself I believe all this bullshit.
It's not bullshit.
Well, there was something about this that was weird, in that several days had gone by since the party blow up, and then he shows up at Michael's house. And so Michael kind of sat on this for several days, not knowing that it was really a health crisis for Ben that triggered his boorish behavior. And I thought that was a little long to wait.
It was a few days, I think, is what they say.
Yeah, I don't think I wouldn't wait several days on this.
No.
I would be like, you're acting like extraordinarily weird and unexpected. I think something's going on here.
Yeah, what happened? What happened? What's going on? Instead, Michael went into his mode of, Ben's not perfect. What do I do?
Yeah, he changed the locks.
Yeah, I mean, I was glad to see that then Michael started to backtrack and try to understand.
Yeah, that's when he got all mama bear.
Yeah, and try and understand what Ben is going through. And he says, you know, I've done all these meditations, and I'm learning that I'm realizing right now that they were all bullshit. Like, he is scared. It makes me really feel for Ben in this moment. Like, he's a nervous wreck, and he's not knowing what could happen.
I do think that Ben has an obligation, though, to fill Michael in on this. Like, that's why he
returned to him, I felt.
Well, these days, I think it would have been a little more instantaneous. You don't go like several days without hearing somebody, because back in 2002, remember, this was when people were hanging around on the sidewalk waiting for Ben to come home to get a few words with him. Now, Ben would get his results from the hospital and immediately text Michael. This just happened. I don't think that this could have carried on for 3 days nowadays. So this is one of those timeliness things that we talk about at the end of these episodes, where parts of the story that might have made sense in the early 2000s don't make sense in the latter half of the 20 teens. There was something I really liked about the park scene with Brian and Michael. It was really, really well directed and well shot. Bruce McDonald does these great outdoor Pittsburgh scenes. It just looked really stylish as Michael's screaming and yelling in the park. I don't know what it was about it. It just looked very unlike Queer as Folk. And it looked good. I really liked it. Exiting out of this scene was a trademark Bruce McDonald unsynced video music carryover to Justin brooding over Brian. And I thought that was pretty clever. It was a narrative swerve to go from the Michael Benn story out of that and into the Brian and Justin story, but it seemed to work pretty well. It was the same thing in that episode with Brian and his mother and Ben and Michael in the park playing basketball, where suddenly we're in Joni Kitchen's kitchen and she's listening to hip hop. And then all of a sudden we're at the playground with the same hip hop track. So he leads in to these new next scenes with the music that he wants to play there. And so you end up in the first scene thinking, what's happening? And then it carries you into the next scene. So I really like how Bruce McDonald does that. It's really cool.
Great direction is all about those transitions.
We're going to take a break and we'll be right back.
Like what you hear? Be sure to subscribe and rate us on iTunes. We like those 5 stars.
Brian, Justin, and the newcomer. We don't yet know his name. We'll get to his name in a minute. But right off the bat in this episode, we see that Justin is a little irked with Brian's status quo. And I started to think, though, isn't Justin busy with art school and his comic? He seems to have plenty of time to stew over Brian these days.
I think it's more that Brian...
He's got a lot of free time.
Well, I think it's more that Justin is noticing how monotonous his relationship with Brian is getting. Of course, they're going to go to Babylon. Of course, they're going to drink. Of course, they're going to stew over which hot guy they should possibly bring
home. All
the
things I hold dear.
Sure. But as a person in a relationship where we now have seen has developed over a season and a half, where's the variety? Like, it feels very much like Justin knows exactly what's going to happen. It's like...
I'd be fine with that happening.
Well, it's now like Brian has become the Ted.
Ah, interesting.
Where everyone knows the exact steps that are going to happen that night.
Right.
And because Justin is the one in this relationship with Brian, he's looking for him to be like, could you maybe not be obsessed with sex for like 5 minutes?
I feel like for several moments in this season, though, Brian does kind of break away from that. And he does do the unexpected with Justin. There's a couple episodes where they said, fuck the game. And they just didn't go after somebody. They just went home together and they had like boyfriend time. So I just thought that this kind of came up very quickly. There wasn't much of a buildup other than the look on Justin's face. Whereas it would have been nice to have maybe a little bit of a reach into the last episode where we could see them starting to bang heads a little bit about what they're doing. This just like came up and all of a sudden Justin's just kind of downtrodden. He's smirking a little bit more like,
Well, this is partially, I think, why they made Justin's birthday the same as Ben's, to give us some dual storylines. So we see how Michael has dealt with Ben's birthday and trying to be extravagant and romantic with it by having a surprise party. And so then we see Justin and how his partner, I'm going to call Brian his partner, is dealing with his birthday, which is, it would be nice for someone to celebrate it. But Brian finds no value in this whatsoever.
That's interesting because I didn't tie the coincidence of the birthdays together at all. It just seemed like that happy coincidence that they could get both birthdays out of the way in one episode. I never felt like there were two opposing storylines or complementary storylines, or that the birthdays really had anything to do with each other. If it did, I just missed it, or it was just lost on me.
I think that what we saw as coincidence at first is now, as we're discussing it, I think meant to give us, here are two sides of the coin.
Here are two people that don't care that it's your birthday. Because sure, one of them, yeah, neither of them were happy that something was done about the birthday, but that's it. I think if we really wanted to see juxtaposition of the two birthdays, Brian would have thrown a momentous birthday party for Justin, whereas Ben did what he did, which is stomped out of his little humble, casually racist birthday party. But there just wasn't anything colliding there. It was just two people that had a birthday on the same date that neither had a happy birthday.
Well, I think it's more that Michael clearly, and because Michael tells Justin, it's his birthday and I want to do something exciting. That's why I stole his Palm Pilot, so I can invite all these people for this party and I want to throw something big. And I think that's where the seed is planted for Justin.
Did going, Justin like, know about that though?
No, he didn't know that, because remember the opening scene is, yeah, Michael explaining like, this is my plan. Oh, and I feel that is a moment for Justin to be like, well,
yeah, why don't I have a secret surprise party?
What is Brian going to do for my birthday?
But that didn't go anywhere, really.
Well, no, and that's I think that's the point. I think that's the point is that...
No, I meant the story didn't really embrace that. Because for Justin, it wasn't so much about his birthday. It was more about hooking up with a violinist or wanting to hook up with a violinist. Justin's birthday seemed to lose importance to Justin, and it was really only like important to the lesbians.
Well, no, and let's break that down, because when Justin is having dinner with Mel and Lindsay, they're like particularly miffed that Brian isn't going to do something for Justin's birthday. You know, this person that he allegedly loves.
Melanie will take a run at Brian for anything. She sees the opportunity she's in.
And it wasn't just Melanie though, because Lindsay was also doing it. And and Melanie is the one who says, what did he do? Brainwash you? Because Justin is trying to say like, it's just a birthday. Who cares? Who thinks that's important while he's like slurping his spaghetti?
Oh yeah. Speaking of that, I called this a lesbian furniture moment because okay, the lesbians didn't have a meaningful story here.
No, they're sort of the pawns to move.
I used to call them lesbian interludes. Now they're lesbian furniture. There was great camera work that starts out with a medium shot of Justin. He's picking out on pasta that the lesbians are serving him. Which, why was he there? What is this dinner? And then the shot pulls away from Justin's first gulp all the way across the dining room table.
As he's...
And another thing. These lesbians are plying a teenager with alcohol.
Well...
Melanie is an officer of the court.
Slammed shots together at parties. Yeah, so at this point, having just a simple glass of wine with dinner is not a huge deal.
I know, but I still find it interesting that the show has such a casual relationship with underage drinking.
Well, they also had a very casual relationship with underage sex. So,
do you give underage people alcohol?
No, but I don't hang out with underage people.
Well, I mean... we both run into people out and about that somehow have wormed their way into a bar and they can't buy a drink for one reason or another, and they're trying to get people to buy them a drink. Or
I literally have never experienced this.
Okay, at a party.
Okay.
With hypothetically a teenage prostitute that was in search of alcohol.
Nope. I'm sorry, Patrick. I'm not going to the same parties you are, so...
This was the same party, but okay. Full disclaimer, he did not buy him liquor.
Okay.
You remember the prostitute I'm talking about, right? Can't think of his name.
I'm literally blanking. I'm sorry.
We run with a fast crowd, ladies and gentlemen.
Yes. But there was just something, I have to continue to talk about it because it bugged me so much.
The alcohol and lesbians?
No, the way Justin was eating this food. Because I feel like acting and shooting food on film is an incredibly difficult thing to do. Because here it was just like, this looks disgusting. Just because it was like slurping it up and just, you know.
I think we only saw him like take two bites though, right?
I think we specifically saw two bites of it. Because the second time when he slurped it up was after they said that they're going to take him to see this violinist who is apparently pretty cute.
The stagecraft here with the pasta eating was pretty good though, because a lot of times in shows with what we'll call low budget, Queer as Folk isn't a high budget show. It's
so-so.
Yeah. You run into problems with food and drink where somebody's drinking an empty cup of coffee. You can tell that there's no liquid in there.
Yes.
Or there's no steam coming out of it. And then you look at expensive shows, high-level shows, you know, like the West Wing, where somebody gets a cup of coffee, it's steaming. There are these little details that go into it. And here, I thought the stagecraft was okay. This was, it looked like pasta. It looked delicious. I would eat that pasta with Justin, as long as the lesbians were serving me.
But compared to certain films that I've seen, like Eat, Drink, Man, Woman, and Tortilla Soup, and Chef, where like food is the centerpiece.
Oh, yeah.
Where you like, you see it on screen and you just went like, I could eat every damn piece of this. It looks amazing. Almost as if you can smell the aroma of all the different food that you're experiencing. And it makes it look so appetizing. Here, I was just really turned off by it.
Well, there was something about this scene that I wasn't too sure about, which is they brainwashed Justin, or I guess Brian brainwashed Justin, then the lesbians rebrainwashed him. Did they have this violin recital planned, or is this just a happy coincidence that, oh, Justin doesn't do parties? Hey, I know. Let's take him to the violin recital tonight. We have free tickets. Three of them.
There was something about saying we were invited to this. You need some culture.
But was that planned? That's why they invited him over? This was like their present to him? Last year, they gave him a box of pencils.
Maybe.
They take him out. Either way, there was a really great timing on the return zoom shot after they say that the fiddle player is cute. It just zooms back in and Justin's smiling. He's like, oh, hot guy.
You're like, why didn't you say so?
Let's go. I did like that cute moment a little while later when Brian was tying Justin's tie, but then he got super condescending.
This isn't the birthday suit I'd like to see you in. There, now go get some culture.
And I didn't like that. I liked the moment where Brian was accepting that Justin's going to go out with the Dykes and he's going to wear a really awful outfit, but it was a tie and he needed to tie it. And I don't know. There's something about somebody tying another man's tie that I like. It's very 1950s Italian cinema thing where two straight men could be that comfortable with one another to tie their ties together.
Yeah, I like that. No. I understand. I get what you're saying in that there's something caring about such an action.
Yeah.
That's really nice.
But then Brian was a dick.
Well, exactly. You know how he starts it? He goes like, didn't your daddy teach you how to tie a tie? And I was glad that Justin threw that back in his face. Like, nah, he was too busy throwing me out and beating you up.
Yeah, I thought that was a comedy moment, though. I don't think that was
Sure, but I was, they were like, really, Brian? Really? Do we really need to hash out all this stuff?
I just had more problems with Brian being condescending about Justin actually going out with the lesbians and going to classical music and the higher forms of entertainment versus Babylon.
Which is so boring after a point.
So at this recital, enter Ethan Gold, the fiddle player extraordinaire.
Complete with the Ty Pennington soul patch.
It's played by Fab Filippo. He's been acting steadily since the mid-1990s. And I did remember him from a few episodes of Buffy the Vampire Slayer. I liked this character immediately. He was cocky and intriguing and mysterious. A totally different gay that we've seen in this series. So far, most of the gays have been pretty, in quotes, gay. This one,
they fit
was the, different.
He was a little pretentious.
Yeah, I loved it.
I had no doubt about that, Patrick, because I wrote that my first impression wasn't great.
Well, okay, so
because he did have that cockiness, full of himself artist.
The Ravel was passable, but the Brahms is for shit.
Blah blah blah.
That's being humble.
Sure.
Humble, yeah, and
he was definitely not humble.
Well, it's being humble and being uncomfortable taking compliments. Taking compliments is an acquired talent.
Okay.
Some people just get embarrassed when
and they're like, oh, you
them.
Know, I had this problem here, I had that problem there.
I don't know.
Or you
could
be like, oh, thank you. You're like, that's exactly what I was going for.
It took me a long time to be able to do your first part there, not the second part, which is if somebody pays me a compliment about some work that I've done, it's taken me a long time to say, oh, thank you so much. I really appreciate that. Before I'd be like, it's not that good.
You like that? Oh.
Yeah. It's like, you like the wrong one. This is about you.
Oh, okay.
So Maybe that's why I empathize with the character a little bit more, because I can see my younger version of myself being like super uncomfortable with somebody complimenting me on something that I'm good at, but I would make mistakes at.
Okay. I will say I loved how they captured his performance, his actual playing. I feel that I've seen a lot of string playing. I was a violist, so I pay attention to this. Really? Especially. Yes,
I didn't know that.
Oh yeah.
Oh, so should we call Ethan the violist?
No, because he was playing the violin. He was playing the violin, so he was a violinist.
You wrote viola in your notes, by the way.
I did. It was a subconscious thing. And because we got so many close-ups on the strings and within his face and capturing so much more of an intimate look at his performance, that it looked so much more realistic than I've seen a lot of string playing in film. A lot of times you can tell, like, oh, you don't know how to hold the bow. You don't know where your fingering positions are whatsoever. This looks like a joke. Here, it looked like he was very, you could almost believe that he was playing it.
I wonder if they had a stunt double playing.
Must have. They must have.
I think the
mix scene was off just a little bit, so that I knew that he probably wasn't really playing, but he was committed to really making it look like he was making those moves. It was so realistic to me that I actually went to IMDb to try and figure out if he actually played.
How would you feel if somebody had drawn 5 pictures of you while you're performing, like Justin did?
I wasn't good enough for you. That's what would have been my reaction. But instead he was intrigued. He was almost complimented by it, because he says, you drew me in 5 variations.
Yeah, I'm Justin.
Ethan.
I know.
What's this?
Oh, it's nothing.
Let me see. It's me in 5 variations.
It's a habit. You know, I can't stop myself.
It's a sign of a true artist.
I just got a whiff of creep there.
I saw it more that he was inspired. It was less creepy, more inspired.
Well, I think Ethan probably took it more as like, I am awesome and beautiful. You deserved to draw me.
No arguments from this corner.
Or actually, I deserve to be drawn.
Thank you for drawing me in my likeness.
Yeah, I just thought it was weird. If I had sketched somebody in that circumstance, I don't think that I would be flailing that piece of work around so that they could see it when I walked over to awkwardly introduce myself, which was my next problem with this scene. Was I think that Justin was just too awkward when he's introducing himself to Ethan. Justin has had a lot of practice being a really good pickup artist. So I just thought that Justin's kind of like stumbling, meek approach to Ethan, the violinist, fiddle player, was just kind of different for Justin. It was almost like Justin 1.0, where Justin was on Liberty Avenue for the first time struggling to light a cigarette. It kind of felt that way, whereas I think Justin's much more accomplished by now.
But I think because of the other pickups we've seen him have, like the virgin at the party, the rando at the art museum, these weren't...
Hot, totally hot.
Totally, for sure. Here, he is seeing someone who may be at the top of their craft, obviously talented, obviously has an ego, and I think that's what makes him a little weak and maybe a little more so, let's say, submissive.
Because
I think that's something that's why he was so intimidated by Brian. That I think that I think Brian and Ethan may share that a little in different, like there are different aspects of it or different parts of the spectrum of it. But I think that's where he's like, drawing, you know,
pencil, paper, here,
pretty. <You know?
laughs> Justin's and Justin comes home from the concert or recital, I think it was, since it just had one person. He comes home and he gets his birthday present from Brian, and look, it's a hunky guy with a bow wrapped around him. I'd be okay with that gift. I'm fine with that gift.
Let's look at Justin's reaction to this, though.
Well, he's disappointed at first, but then he does his duty and just dives on it.
I think he does it just to make Brian happy.
Unlike Ben, issued the party.
Justin's like, this is what Brian wants. Right, what you feel should have been Ben's reaction to Michael's surprise party, Justin sort of acquiesces to the gift that is presented before him, which is, I guess I'll have sex with this hustler. Because he was so excited. He thought he was getting something a little more grand and romantic. Instead, it's like, great, you got me a dick.
Loved it.
That, hey, that dick did not disappoint. I mean, you yeah. saw it. I mean, so Justin's disappointed, but the escort was not disappointing. I will say that.
The next day, Justin just happens to be wandering through the music department of his school.
And just so happens to be.
Ethan is, I thought Ethan's like very charming in an anti-Brian way because.
Oh, but he's still just enough of a dick.
No, I loved it because he's using words like make love.
Because if I was your boyfriend, I'd give you a birthday you'd never forget.
Like what?
Like, first, I'd bring you breakfast in bed. And then I'd play for you one of Ravel's vaults, noble et sentimental, because that's how I picture you. Noble and sentimental. And then we'd make love a couple hundred times.
So I like those little charming differences. They were a little obtuse. It was a little purposeful to differentiate them. But I did like that Ethan comes across as a romantic. Brian comes across as the trick.
Agreed. The way Ethan was saying, this is how I would have celebrated your birthday. I would have played you this.
Yeah, exactly.
We would have made love 200 times. And I was just like,
loved it.
Oh, my God.
Oh, I love that.
And he just went back to playing.
Yeah, Justin's like looking it up like catnip. He's just like, I want this.
It's that kind of thing where you're like fanning yourself. Like, did he just say that?
There's a really nice exit shot out of this practice room where we see the metronome clicking away. And it just goes back just as Justin's going back to class. It's as if Justin was just marking time to go home to Brian. So I like that. That was a clever little pan out and then a little side pan over to the clicking metronome. Really subtle. I like that, Bruce McDonald. Thank you. So later, Justin's listening to Ethan's CD in the loft, and this was wonderfully staged because the camera didn't move at all, and Justin was just rolling around the loft in a wheeled chair, almost like a figure skater doing a routine. There was just this grace and harmony to him that we hadn't seen him do with Brian. We see him more emoting, I think, and more graceful with it. So I like that. There's another McDonald overlap cut to Brian in the park contemplating buying flowers. Brian ends up not buying the flowers. He passes on that.
He's just like, no thanks.
And he walks off kind of alone into the night. And there's a Rufus Wainwright song playing there. It's called Poses. And there's a lyric there that I jotted down that I thought was pretty meaningful. And again, the music supervision here is great. And it's unfortunate that you don't get to hear these wonderful music cues when you're watching Netflix or Showtime.com.
Because Rufus Wainwright is amazing.
The lyrics goes, all these poses, such beautiful poses, make any boy feel like picking up roses. And Brian didn't pick them up. Put them down, walked away from it. We get so close to seeing Brian become even slightly committal to Justin, but he puts it down. And this is a real tipping point in the storyline, because we later see that if only Brian had done that one simple thing of giving Justin this tiny little sprig of roses, that nothing in the next five episodes with Ethan Gold ever would have happened. This is the moment. The show jumps the shark in so many ways, but this storyline I really like. I really like the split between Ethan and Brian and Justin. So this was an important moment.
I'm still stuck on the Rufus Wainwright. Sorry.
We'll be right back and wrap things up with Ted and his choir boy. Still Queer as Folk. There's more on the way. If you like our show, please give us a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts. Emmett starts to find himself pretty aimless after the death of George. He's tried boys, booze, but he's still missing something in his life. So Ted to the rescue. He's going to take Emmett to church, in quotes.
Church.
What in the world was this church?
I have no fucking clue.
Isn't Reverend Brad incredible?
Yeah, he should win a Tony.
This is not a dress rehearsal, kids. Let us sell it to the balcony and beyond. Rise, rise, and follow in your hymnals.
This was a show tune service.
My note on this literally is, what show queen nonsense is this?
Ted has never been religious anyway, so where did this come from?
It's not really religious. It feels like it's less religion and more motivational speaker.
Like up with people?
Yes, complete with sequin jacket and Hello Dolly.
I thought it was funny. It seems like the type of thing that we'd run into someplace, but in this story, it's like, where did this come from? What is this?
Exactly. Like, what would have driven Ted to this?
Yeah, totally. Ted meets an appropriate man and helps him collect the hymnals. So this guy's got it all.
I was with the Peace Corps for a few years, but then I decided what I really wanted was to work with kids.
That's sweet. Oh,
ever teach second graders? Sweet's not exactly the word.
I'm sure they adore you.
I love it. And it allows me time in the evenings to volunteer at the gay youth support line and to train for the AIDS ride on the weekend. And then, of course, I help out at the church.
Ooh. He's so G-rated.
Yeah, he's so, like, perfect male.
And named Luke, no less. So Luke. There's another religious tie-in for you.
And Ted's a pornographer, but instead he works in computers and runs his own .com company dealing with people's needs. He does relief work.
Relief work. He relieves so many people.
So right off the bat, Ted's lying to this guy. And then,
he's telling the truth creatively is how I would put it.
Well, either way, then they have a super hot sex scene.
Have we seen 69ing before?
I don't know. I'm sure. Yeah, I think Brian and Justin have.
Well, okay. Because there was, I took that scene as so much more erotic and like almost tantric than the sort of frantic sex scenes that we've seen before.
Well, I think this is Bruce McDonald at work. Interestingly, in this sex scene, it was red and white. Normally, his sex scenes are blue. So that was interesting. There's a lot of extreme close-ups, sexy music, panting.
Yeah, and like a lot of moaning. I was just like, geez. Okay, Ted. You don't get it.
Ted comes clean about his job. Like, at the moment when Luke is like the most vulnerable, he's naked, he's just been fucked. Ted says, oh, by the way, I am everything that you despise in the world.
And Luke was saying things that were so on the nose. Like, you're so honest. I can trust you completely.
Yeah, it's like, whoa.
Like, okay, I think you've hit it on the nose, and now you're just kind of hitting around the face, too.
Yeah, those are the run for the fences moments.
I'm like, hi, we've known each other for 3 days.
There was another attempt at cheap laughs in this storyline, and that took place at Ben's party before Ben had shown up and ended the party. Melanie, Lindsay, and Emmett were all saying rather unflattering things about Ted.
And how much he loves the porn.
Yeah.
Porn.
And I think this was under the guise of trying to make Ted look good, but no, they were just cheap lines.
He thinks you're very special.
You've got to be, considering what he does.
The dick channel. All dick, all the time.
Well, this is by far the most interesting discussion in the room.
We're just saying how great it is that Luke's so open-minded about Ted's porn site. Not everyone would be.
Well, I admire someone who's passionate about what he does.
Oh, he's passionate, all right. Eats, drinks, sleeps, porn, 24/7. Porn.
Oh, our little entrepreneur, he's not going to stop there.
Yeah, he's far too ambitious for that.
I'm sure he's got like a dozen other websites planned.
Film studio.
Theme park.
It did plant the seed for what I thought was interesting about this storyline, which is how we feel we are going to be perceived based on what our partners do. In that, Luke is hearing about, at first is saying, oh, it's totally fine. I get it. I've even been to your site a couple of times. Oh, I'm right, not yeah. And then to sort of get hit with a harder truth of how much this porn business Ted is really involved in, then makes Luke think, can I really be with someone whose profession is this?
Well, the first thing was, it seemed like Luke thought that he could. And then Ted made the mistake that just because of this one line from Luke that everything would be fine, Luke shows up at the porn company. And I just think that Ted should have picked up on these signs earlier, though, because Luke was obviously not open to dating a porn kingpin. And Ted was acting like he got out of jail free card.
Like, isn't he just the sweetest? He's the most perfect. It's the same thing that we noticed that Michael was doing with Ben.
Then there's
putting him on a pedestal. Almost.
There's another weird thing from Ted here where Luke is casting him off and Ted totally gaslights him and says, I'll do whatever you want. I'll even give up the business. It's like, Ted, you just met this guy.
Like 2 weeks
at
ago.
At church.
2-3 weeks
you
ago.
You can't give up your company.
It's an empire that you are building and you're ready to throw it away for this one guy that you hardly know. Although I will say I found it a smart choice for when Luke is visiting the set and he's trying to have this conversation with Ted about how uncomfortable he actually is, that they use the environmental sounds of the site. It kind of gets accentuated at certain moments of their discussion. It fed into Luke's perspective of how unappealing this really is. So I thought that was a really smart way to show that this is clearly from Luke's perspective and how unappetizing all this really was.
I thought this story was just because Ted should not have been that deep into it. He should not have been willing to give up everything.
He threw himself full force into it.
They were showing, Bruce McClellan here was showing us season one Ted, where he could never get laid. He could never get a guy to pay attention to him. And now a guy pays attention to him, they hit it off, and then Ted will do anything to keep him. But that's not the Ted that's evolved into the porn kingpin. The porn kingpin Ted is much more self-confident, self-assured. He is becoming a man of wealth. It didn't make sense.
He's starting to be able to hang with the A-gays. Yeah.
Yeah. So why would his character track that way? It just makes sense. And Luke kind of reminded me of that 20-minute imaginary fling that Emmett had in Babylon.
Yes.
It was just exactly. this kind of archetype that comes in, plays out a storyline, and then it's just gone.
Yes, why couldn't Luke have stuck around for a few episodes?
Yeah, like Roger.
Yeah, or in scene. Maybe in the next episode, he tries to see what the whole porn thing is about. And then in the next episode, he realizes it's too much. Like this
Ted like convinces him to do porn. And then he has a fallout with his church. There's tons that could happen.
And his second graders.
You're right. He gets caught being a teacher. He gets fired.
The drama of that alone.
Yes.
Infinitely more interesting.
So let's tie up this episode here. Timeliness. I gave this one the middle of the road 3. Because the story didn't really draw me into present tense in any meaningful way. It was what it was. It didn't really set itself in 2002. It didn't really set itself in 2018. So, 3.
I was on the 3 path, but that party and the representation of that party really knocked it down to a 2 for me. And that whole party portion of this episode would never air today.
Information accuracy, I gave this one a 4.
Oh.
I thought that the HIV information in this one is accurate, though it's somewhat less common now that this happens to people unless they stop taking their medication. It's basically what happens if a positive person stops taking their meds. This is what can happen. So I thought that for once there was a little bit more thought put into how to deal with the HIV positive medication healthcare piece.
I gave it 3. And honestly, for some of the reasons that you stated the medication cocktail now is so much more stable, and that whereas in 2002, clearly the right.
There was only one cocktail then. Now there's like couple dozen.
So people are able to find more stability within their status.
And, yeah, depending on the strain that they have and depending on what stage they're in and how it's responding to the one that the medication that they're targeting. So relatability, I give this one a 3. The Brian, Justin, Ethan story was very relatable to me. The rest of the storylines, though, were pretty throwaway, like Ben having his little freak out and ordering people out of the party. And the Ted story, it didn't really relate to that one. So I had to knock it down for the 2 stories that I didn't like. But the Brian, Justin, Ethan story was really the only one that carried this episode for me.
I actually gave this a 4.
Ooh.
In that I think when you find yourself to being complacent in a relationship and how you find variety in that between Justin and Brian.
Call hookers.
And then there's also, I guess I found it more relatable, the Luke and Ted portion of the storyline than you did, because I feel like there's something to be said for, if you know what your partner does for a living, can you reconcile if you feel like it is quote unquote less than reputable? I feel like if you see on a lot of like dating apps that people put what their profession is, and if you can see it and you're like, oh, that's what you do, swipe left. Oh, that's what you do, swipe right. I feel like our profession has more weight than we'd like to think, and that image does play out a lot in relationships.
Okay. So that's our verdict on season 2, episode 16. You say it's your birthday? I couldn't care less.
Next week, Brian cancels plans with Justin in order to impress his new boss.
Emmett receives a surprising gift from George.
And Lindsay and Melanie try to spice up their relationship.
Ugh. That will be episode 17 of season 2, and it's called You Can Lead a Girl to Pussy. Lita being the female lesbian character. We are still Queer as Folk. Please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to us, and subscribe. It really does mean a lot to us, and it helps more people find our show.
Check us out on Twitter at StillQueerAF and like us on Facebook at StillQueerAsFolk.
If you want to contact us personally, you can find me on Instagram at Patrick Randall, all one word.
And I'm on Instagram and Twitter at MatthewPD.
Thanks for joining us. I'm Patrick Randall.
And I'm Matt Dominguez. We'll see you next week.
Still, Queer as Folk was written and performed by Patrick Randall and Matt Dominguez.
New episodes every Wednesday as we take apart the show one episode at a time.
Available now on iTunes,
Google Play,
Stitcher,
TuneIn,
Overcast,
Pocket Cast, and all your other favorite podcatchers.
Still, Queer as Folk is made with love in Chicago.